My name is Jeff Moore. I live currently on Bainbridge Island in near Seattle. I have just come back from New Orleans, where I was a volunteer with Common Ground, an organization that sort of spontaneously grew up from the lack of response to the Hurricane Katrina. It's been quite a interesting 3 weeks, but it wasn't the first time I'd been to Louisiana, or the second or third. I actually graduated in Shreveport, Louisiana in 1969. I was very attracted to go back there. I'd grown up in a military family, so we'd lived a lot of places, but in Louisiana, one of the important attributes that the place has going for it is that family matters a lot, and there's a lot of closeness and sharing that I became, you know, sort of part of as I was finishing up my high school years. But there was a lot else going on in Louisiana, and I had a pretty good look at the, you might say, the darker side of it. One day, an airman, I was living on a base at that time, invited me to go with him on horseback, and we were going to go, and he was going to show me something, and I didn't know what it was. So we rode and rode and rode out into the sticks off the base and into the surrounding countryside. We came upon shacks that were, the walls of which were as much holes as wood, and there were rows of them, and behind them were fields, and what we were looking at was sharecropping. And I'd never seen anything like it. It looked like one might imagine slavery looked, the sort of poverty and dusty, you know, ignorance and just lack of modernity. You know, you didn't see telephone wires or even electricity. And the children were barefoot, and in front of the shacks there might be an automobile, or there might be a pig tied to a post, or... And behind the shack would be a field, not very big, probably half an acre. And I was given to understand that from that field came the earnings of the sharecropper. And he got half of the output of the field, and the owner of the field got the other half. And it didn't strike me that there was much of an improvement from slavery in this system, and I had no idea it still existed in 1969, and I have no idea if it doesn't still exist right now, but that was one of my experiences then. In my junior year in high school, which would have been 1968, we had the usual elections for class student or student class positions. That year we elected a black woman class president. That was just unacceptable to the principal, who was a hardcore John Birch Society member. And he and his acolytes among the students annulled the election. In other words, they just the president of the student, of the junior student council position didn't exist for a while after the election. And they held a new election. And to their chagrin, I suppose, we re-elected her with a whopping majority. So he annulled the whole council system for the year. And this look at sort of straight-up racism, unvarnished, was a new one for me. Also in that year, a little later, after the beginning of that year, maybe around Christmas, I began working with a nun. She was not a nun anymore because she'd been thrown out of her cloister for the work that she was doing. And what she was doing was setting up a breakfast program for black kids in the inner city schools. Kids were coming hungry to school. She set about to fix it. And exactly what the problem was between her and her cloister, she didn't share with me. Remember, I was just a youngster at that time, and so there was no point for her, I guess, to explain her motives and their motives to me. She continued to do this work, and it was quietly supported by the local priest of the big Catholic church, who gave her money and gave her support. And besides the breakfast program, we were engaged in a distribution of food and clothing to exclusively to blacks in also in Shreveport. So for that year, I would get out of school twice a week and go down to the breakfast program, and then those on the same days after school, work with her on the distribution program. And she would go and she would hustle grocery store owners for free food, and she would collect the box tops and make a request or a demand of the grocery store owner that they honor those box tops at 10 times their face value. So if it was worth a tenth of a penny, which it often was, then it became a penny. And she collected these things ferociously, and the priest and many other liberals in Shreveport helped to collect these box tops. And with that kind of effort, she was able to provide tennis shoes and food and some clothing and whatnot to several black families in Shreveport. But this look at the underclass of Shreveport, it didn't even stop there. As a teenager in the 60s, my involvements took me into Shreveport and some of the, you might say, older young people of Shreveport, where I saw a lot of injustice there having to do with the criminal justice system. So I was meeting young black men, just a few, who were pursued, more or less, by the police. Even though they were involved in mildly criminal activity that I was aware of, the pursuit was way beyond that of a criminal in prospect of a prosecution. This was name-calling and stopping and intimidation by the police. So with that background in Louisiana, I had a pretty good idea that when I went back to New Orleans, this time as a volunteer in Common Ground, that I would still see a very layered system with blacks at the bottom and our national government, I suppose, at the top. That turned out very much to be the case, and the reminder of that and the visual images that I keep with me from the latest trip to New Orleans leave me no doubt that our system at large is broken. Before I went to New Orleans in the wake of Katrina, I was listening to the news and looking at email and online to try to stay abreast of events, because it's pretty clear that something huge was going on in New Orleans. Some of the stories that I heard that attracted me to go down to try to do the same kinds of things I'd done in the 60s, one of those stories was that 500 prisoners had been left in their cell. 500 prisoners were missing. They were simply off the rosters after Katrina hit. Amy Goodman's show, I understood that they had been left in their cells with no food and water to a rising tide. So it was most of these men and women were in for misdemeanor charges, but this was to be their execution by drowning, because the guards and the prison staff had left, and there was no chance for their escape, you know, out of their cells. I also heard, for the first time, Malik Rahim's voice on Amy Goodman's show, and heard for the first time about Common Ground. And what Malik had done after Katrina, actually during Katrina, was to try to solve, in his own way, the problem of the prisoners that were drowning. And he went off and found a boat, rowed to Old Parish Prison, began releasing people that he knew. I never asked Malik, you know, I had several chances and talked with him at length, but I didn't ask him about that story, so I won't make any more of it than I just did. Again, on Amy's show on the prisoners, nearly all of the prisoners, after they escaped the death in their cell, they reincarcerated themselves and presented themselves to the police, and that was a story. That part of the story made the mainstream news, too, because they were then kept for a couple days on a highway overpass, and by their accounts, without food and water. Another story that I heard before I left was about a book called Farewell Bayou, which I haven't read, but I understood from the interview with the author that he had fairly well predicted events that transpired during Katrina, that the levees would break, that the poorest would be hit, and had published his book several months ahead of Katrina. But I also knew that the Army Corps of Engineers had asked for money to fix the levees prior to Katrina, and actually for decades had requested that, made those requests for the billions of dollars to bring the levees back up to snuff. Neither Clinton nor Bush in the 12 years of their presidencies had given adequate money to the Corps of Engineers to fix the levees. Bush had, the Bush administration and those making the assignments of budget dollars had specifically stated that the money, they couldn't fix the levees because they needed that money for the war in Iraq. That calculation leads pretty straight ahead in my mind to the idea that destroying Iraq, which is, I think, what's happening, cost us New Orleans, because the money that should have gone to levies instead has gone to make Iraq the living hell that it is. Another story that everybody got from mainstream news or alternative news was that when the levees broke in Katrina, the people's adjacency to badly constructed and ill-maintained levees, and in fact their elevation above or below seawater, was directly related to their socioeconomic status. In other words, the worst levees were by the poorest people. So when the levees failed or were dynamited, whichever story you give credence to, the devastation of the flood happened for the poorest people in their homes. And the story of the dynamiting, I have no knowledge that that did or didn't happen, except that in talking to people in New Orleans, there's a widespread belief that the levees didn't fail from natural causes, but instead the poor areas in the Ninth Ward were used as a sort of a pressure relief mechanism for the levee system, so that the levees would fail at their lowest point, relieving pressure on the rest of New Orleans, which almost uniformly is of a higher socioeconomic status. I also heard stories about waiters being shot by vigilantes as they either got provisions or were just waiting out of the flooded city. And there was a well-publicized story of a group of 90 people who attempted to cross the Gretna Bridge, or the major bridge over the Mississippi River connecting East and West New Orleans. In this story, there were whites and blacks, but largely a black group, this 90. They had waded out of New Orleans and began to cross this bridge, which was uninhabited pretty much because there was nobody driving at that point. Were stopped at the Gretna side of the bridge by the Gretna chief of police and his men. Police chief was having none of these blacks come into Gretna, which happens to be the home of David Duke. The police shot over the escapees' heads in order to frighten them back into the waters of New Orleans. The escapees then found some higher ground and began to make a makeshift encampment with plastic bags and whatever they could get their hands on to protect themselves from the rain and whatever food they could gather. And they'd made a makeshift encampment, but their presence there was still too much for the powers that be, and a helicopter came in and blew, using the downwash of the props of the helicopter, blew their encampment to bits. And police came in and took the food, and also gave orders to the 90 to disperse. In other words, they didn't want to see large groups of people. So we're left to wonder what the motivations of the police would be, not to let them escape into Gretna, not to let them encamp together where they could at least have each other's company in their misery. And the only conclusion I can draw from that was that because the media was there and would more easily spot 90 people than a smaller group, especially in an encampment, it was not a desire of the powers that be, and the police in particular, that the media be able to spot these people wishing to get out of the dire straits that people were in who had been unable, or for one reason or another, had not left New Orleans. Another story I heard before I left was of the Fisher Project. I'll talk more about that later. One of the stories that I've heard for years is, well, it's not a story. It's something I heard directly from our federal chairpersons of the Federal Reserve Bank. And Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan use this term structural unemployment. First time I heard that back in the, I think it was late 80s or early 90s, it struck me that a Federal Reserve chairman setting the economic policy for the country using a term like structural employment brings up more questions than it answers. But he was good enough to give an answer of what structural unemployment was. In Volcker's explanation, he explains that 5% of the population needs to remain unemployed in order to prevent inflation. And so you might wonder, well, why would keeping 5% of the population unemployed prevent inflation? But the generous Volcker explains that the upward pressure on wages is the strongest form of inflation. And by keeping 5% unemployed, you can then escape the ominous pressure, upward pressure on wages, and clip inflation that might be driven by wages. But then you might ask, well, who are these 5% unemployed? Probably all of us have experienced moments or even years or whatever of unemployment. But there's a deeper layer of this 5%. I had no doubt that the people I had seen, the blacks particularly, but whites too, I had seen in Louisiana in 69 and in New Orleans, and would see when I went to New Orleans in 2005, would be in a group of people who roughly make up a whopping segment of that 5%. And they're not just occasionally unemployed, but as a group, they're overwhelmingly unemployed, maybe at 60%. And not unemployed for a decade, but for decades, so that the unemployment is a part of their existence generation after generation. So Volcker's explanation went a long way to explain to me how policies set by the most powerful people can and do impact generations of Americans and the economy as a whole. In other words, by keeping some people in a permanently desperate situation, it does indeed have a downward pressure on wages, as Volcker hopes. But the circumstances of those people's lives is so diminished that their impact on the rest of us is negative, in the sense that crime, when there's a lack of a normal economy, humans will create an economy. And that economy often involves illicit things that are not allowed in the proper white economy, such as drugs, prostitution, and various other illegal activities. And so people without jobs will create jobs, even if there's no legitimate jobs, legitimate as defined by the dominant society, available. So I went down to Louisiana, to New Orleans directly. I drove straight through and just sleeping a couple of times along the way because I was very anxious to get there. And immediately set to work. I'm a carpenter, and I set to work doing carpentry within Common Ground. The volunteers there, and there were probably already 100 there, were virtually without showers. The available shower was a plastic bag hung on a hook and with a little straw with a stopcock at the end of it, and so you could squat down under this trickle of water and take your shower. But it was hot in the day and cold at night, and taking a shower in that way is slow, and most showers being taken at night were cold, and so Malik and the other volunteers were trying to assemble a shower house with a solar hot water heating capability. And I'd done these things before and was confident, I could do it again, and did. So I immediately set to work virtually, an hour after I'd parked my truck. I was at work finishing a shower. All that was there to begin with was 6 posts in the ground. We went out and bought materials and built the walls and installed the shower stalls, composting toilets, and then began work on the solar systems, and the very rudimentary but very effective solar systems that we built. So that was the bulk of my work there, but I would get called away almost every day. But one of those days, it was to build a ramp for a paraplegic, a man who who has diabetes, which is, I guess, almost at epidemic proportions in among the black community and elder black community in New Orleans. He had no legs, and he'd lost a hand when he'd lost his medical care during Katrina. And he needed a ramp just to get up into his house. And his wife had been hoisting him from his wheelchair up in onto a porch, which was at waist level. And she and he were about the same size. It was quite a job for her and him to accomplish it. So I built a ramp and did various patching on houses whose floors had crumbled, and I'm just throwing plywood over the floor and nailing that down to keep people from falling through their own floors, and various other things that related to carpentry, but mostly building this solar shower. But at night, after the sun went down, there was a building stopped. You know, sometimes we'd work under the lights, but usually not, and I was tired, and so I just talked to people, the other volunteers, and they were doing all kinds of things, and I think we'll get to that a little later. One of the things I noticed when I got to New Orleans was that some of the volunteers there called me Mr. Jeff, and they called the women who were my age, I'm 54, Mrs. whatever their names were, so Mrs. Sharon or Mrs. what have you, or Miss, not Mrs. I had to think about this, and it struck me that this is sort of reminiscent of plantation culture. To have it applied to me was unflattering in a way. I mean, they meant it as flattering, but it's a sign of deference. And for people in New Orleans to give me deference because I'm older or because I'm a carpenter or because of whatever their perceptions of me made me uncomfortable. And so I'd question them sometimes on that. But there was a gentility, kind of a sense of servitude and honor and a very slow pace of life. And all of these attributes struck me as a sort of 1800s sort of culture that remains in a modern world. I mean, of course, people in New Orleans have their computers and fly in jet planes and use modern appliances and what have you. But behind all of that, there remains this slow pace of life that seems to me related to a slow pace of economics, where adjoining towns or nearby big cities like Houston are sailing along with investment money and new industries and new buildings. New Orleans is not, and it retains its old world charm and old world architecture and its old world culture. And this is charming, but it's indicative of a place where economics has not developed in the same way that it has in most American cities. The other thing that might strike anyone going to New Orleans is the rich cultural mixture that exists there. There are Creoles and Cajuns, even black groups who identify as American Indians. So you can meet a black man who will tell you that he's a Mohawk. He belongs to a club of Mohawks or a tribe, he calls it. And another thing that strikes you is the accents. There are numerous accents, and some of them hard for me with my whatever Midwestern mindset to communicate with. So I often found myself in the position of asking people, well, what did you say? Could you repeat that? And often being so caught up in how people were saying what they said that I often missed the content of what they said and having to ask them to repeat themselves for that reason. It's very much a different place, and often, particularly as regards development, looks a little bit like a third world country. When I got to Common Ground, I met Malik, and he granted me time right away, and we spent about an hour and a half, and sat down on the foundation of the showers to be and talked. And I questioned him closely about leadership and politics. He did most of the talking, and what he did was outline a pretty elegant vision of the future and how Common Ground could play a role in the economic development of the poorest people in New Orleans by providing training for the rebuilding of New Orleans. Now, the powers that be, of course, have a totally different way of doing the rebuilding, which is to bring in labor, and currently they're bringing in Mexican labor at very low wages, and of course with the usual lack of civil rights that Mexicans experience in this country. So perhaps an inability to get a driver's license, to make complaints should they be mistreated at work. But Malik's vision was to do this training and to set up a carpentry school. And so he was interested in talking to me, I suppose, because I had, you know, 25 years experience in carpentry and could play a role in setting the school up. And so he laid out his vision, I would say in detail, except that his visions are not just about carpentry schools, but that's pretty much that was sort of the gist of what we talked about. But I questioned him about politics, too, at the time. Malik has a very elegant way of speaking, and he's very moderated in his tone, but he also reminded me of Martin Luther King, in as much as he could elicit this sense of injustice and a sense of holding one's ground against the injustice, as well as offering solutions for the powers that be to do, which is, you know, to give vouchers for, instead of, one of his suggestions was to give vouchers to people to fix their house rather than billions to the favored few of the Bush administration, the Halliburtons and the Bechtels. His vision and his style of speaking offer something both to the powers that be and primarily to the people without power and who've been left in the economic dustbin for centuries, if not at least for the last decades. So I was impressed with Malik.